es una vida, es de extraño, pero no es
Cuando yo quiero tener un hijo,
Okay, yes, that's right. If it's I don't want anyone to be embarrassed that they don't know English, because it's not the language that everybody needs to know. So I will try to speak very clearly, since I myself learned English as an adult. I wanted first of all to thank Desiga Vilova and for the invitation and for this incredible pleasure of being here and speaking to you about a topic that is very emotional for me, because I'm part of 1968 generation, and that now I am on my way to Poland, to Warsaw, for the celebration of commemoration kind of events around 1968 anniversary of student movement, which was a very dramatic part of my life, and was really a moment which changed everything in my life, and was and therefore I'm very nervous about this, all of these events. And as it's very good for me to be able to speak about it, first of all in a language that is foreign to me, and secondly somehow trying to look at it a little bit objectively. Although I'm not talking directly about 68, even if you are interested, of course I can talk about it. But what I'm talking is about today, about this kind of understanding one of the topics of the conversation that is today happening, and that is linked to 1968 events. The main issue, of course, that is here, the most important, is the question of national identity. And I know, reading about various other countries in Europe, that it is an issue that is very common to many countries, and not only East European countries, but also West European countries. For example, I don't know if you read that about a week or 2 weeks ago, the British government of Gordon Brown decided to build a museum of Britishness and asked the population to come up with a motto about what it is to be British, what is Britishness. In France, the previous government was very much working on rehabilitating French colonial history, and a new holiday, national holiday, was introduced. A new center of research about the Maghreb countries was created. In Germany, there's a building of the Center for the Expellees, and the kind of revindication of the suffering of the German civilian population during Second World War. Of course, Eastern European countries, or East Central European countries, have more, even more reasons somehow to worry about their national identity issue, because 1989 was a moment in which everything changed. Almost everything changed in these countries. And now, in Poland at least, but I guess in other countries as well, there is a return to history. This return to history is due to various very good reasons, like, for example, the fact that some part of history was not open to for discussion, that only the German persecution of the Polish population was discussed, but the Russian not. But there are also other reasons, and these other reasons are reasons of politics. Today, each of the new parties, each of the group that are at power, each of them are building for themselves a pedigree in the past. They use history to justify what they want to do in the present. So So there is a tension between the fact that the countries like Poland are members now of the European Union. They are open and they are opening to various new cultures, political decisions, political issues, and other people and so on. But on the other hand, there is a certain quite desperate need for continuity, for maintaining national history, for being not kind of getting lost in this big family of nations. I think that this national identity issues in the Western Europe also are due to the similar facts, to the dominance of the United States, to globalization, to the kind of surrounding part of sovereignty, national sovereignty, being part of NATO and European Union. But this tension is much more felt, I think, in Eastern Europe. And I feel that the reaction, at least the reaction that I can observe in Poland, is kind of allergic. This is like an allergy. There are certain symptoms, and there are certain reactions that come out that are truly sickly. What is specific about Poland is that it is a country that has been ethnically cleansed during Second World War. It is a country that always, in this part of Europe, whatever was the form of Poland, when it existed as a state and when it didn't, it was always multinational, multi-ethnic, and multi-religious. Only after Second World War, it became a one ethnicity, one religion country. It has 1% of minorities. It is a nation of almost 40 million, and it has 1% of minorities, of all minorities. And in the 2002 census, population census, to the question of nationality, there were 1,133 people who replied that they were Jews. And there were 1,112 people who replied that they were Bulgarians. So only 21 people, the difference between them. And before the war, one third of the Polish population was Jewish. And you, of course, know that during the war, that population has been exterminated, and that Poland has been moved, its borders have been moved, and one third of the Polish territory has been ethnically cleansed. That is, all the German population, because this was German territory, all population has been expelled from there, and the eastern population of Poland was moved there and settled on these territories. And so, this is a new situation for Poland, really new, in which the dream of the right-wing nationalists from 1930s has been implemented, thanks to Mr. Stalin and Mr. Hitler. And Poland, for the first time, is this kind of unified nation. Now, these people, this 1,133 people who replied that they are Jews, of course, this is not the real number, because the question was asked in a way that forced people to reply very, just to say one thing, that is, you couldn't say that you were a Pole of Jewish origin or a Polish Jew. You had to say, I am a Jew. And probably if this question were to be asked in a different way, there would have been many more people. But how many more? Probably, I don't know, 10,000, 20,000, the maximum of 30,000 in a population of 40 million. So there are very few Jews in Poland, but there is a very big problem with Jews. And some an anthropologist who was working on this issue, she wrote that she thought that Poles, in a way, have to produce Jews because they are inscribed into the Polish DNA, into Polish history, so that it is impossible in a certain way to think about Poland without thinking about these Jews, however imaginary. And there is now an effort on the part of the government and various governments, but especially it was of the last government, not the one that is now at present, of, in a certain way, show the Poland as they understand that it is. Because Poles are very much oppressed by the idea that the world outside of Poland is seeing Poland as not the main victim of the Second World War. That the Jewish suffering and that the extermination of Jews was something that was taken by the outside world as something that was more important than the suffering of Poles. And therefore there is in a certain way, a paradoxical situation in which stronger is Poland as a state, and it is very unusual for itself, strong now, and secure, and part of international kind of coalition and defended, more forcefully the Polish government shows the victimhood of Poland. There are museums being built all the time. There's a museum, for example, Lech Kaczyński, who is now the president. Before that, he was the mayor of Warsaw. As a mayor of Warsaw, he built the Museum of Warsaw Insurrection. There was an insurrection in 1944 in Warsaw. Warsaw raised against Germans when the Russians were already arriving. The Polish government in exile, Poles didn't want to be liberated by the Russians. They wanted to liberate the capital by themselves. The Russians stopped and allowed the Germans the real destruction of the city and its population. There were 200,000 victims. It was an unmitigated disaster. Now there's in Warsaw, there's this incredibly modern, built on the model of Holocaust Museum, modern museum, kind of interactive, in which children come and fill out the papers, you know, and kind of take on the identity of one of the persons that died, and so on. All of it based on this commemoration of Holocaust martyrs for that disaster of Polish history. There are other museums that are being built and that have been the project of this Kaczyński government, and that new government, which discontinued several things, is continuing these projects, several of them, several mini museums, centers, and so on. There's also a gigantic effort to find the name of every single person that died, every single Pole that died during the Second World War, and to identify and describe these people. And there's also the Institute of National Memory established, which has its main function somehow to see, it's a lustration institution, but they also produce documents about various historical events and books. And they are really representing a very right-wing nationalistic tradition in Polish history. So this vision of martyrdom of Poland is in a certain way very polemical. It's not for inside, for Poles themselves in a certain way, although it does inside, that does kind of support the dignity of the nation, but it is directed to this outside world that does not appreciate us. Now, into this narration of history, from time to time there are some scandalous books that are thrown in, and one of them is being discussed right now, and it is somehow also linked with this 1968 event. This is a book by Jan Tomasz Gross, who is a historian and who teaches also part of 1968 generation, who teaches in the United States. And he wrote a book, he wrote a few years ago, a book about the Holocaust in Poland, which was called Neighbors, and in which he has proven that there was an sporadic, but there was a participation of the Polish population in the chasing and kind of eliminating of Jews. And he proved it on the example of a village, of a little town, in which the Polish neighbors really exterminated or helped. I mean, there were no German presence there, no physical German presence, because it was instigated by the Nazis, but it was not, there were no Germans at this place. Now he wrote another book, and this book is about, it's called Fear, and it is about the attitude of Polish population towards Jews after the end of the war, in 1945, 1948, basically. And this is a period in which there were pogroms, and there were assassination of returning Jews, and there was assassination of people called, there were actions, so-called train actions, in which, you know, people traveling on the trains or buses or something were being killed because they looked Jewish. It was within the context of civil war, because it was the time of the imposition of the communist regime, and the Jews became, at least this is the explanation that is given officially, because these facts are not disputed, that the Jews became somehow affiliated with imposition of communism. Of course, this is in a certain profound way absolutely not true, because the Jews who did survive, and the Jews who did return from the Soviet Union, who survived the war in the return, they all, as soon as they were able to, they escaped from Poland and the communist regime en masse. And only some of the most Polonized Jews remained. And these Jews were then invited to emigrate in 1968. And I want to talk about it just for a moment. This is kind of a historical context, but since it is about Poland, I have to make a step back to history and talk about an insurrection and romanticism and poetry and text. I'll try to be quick. There's a conference to which in fact I'm going right now to Warsaw. It is organized by a woman professor who is the biggest specialist on romanticism in Poland. Her name is Maria Janian. And she wrote an essay about historical figure, a colonel in the Polish army, insurrection of 1794. It was a Kościuszko insurrection, if anyone of you ever heard about it. It was, of course, an unsuccessful anti-Russian insurrection, and this colonel, Berek Joselewicz, is so unusual because he was a Jew. He was a Jew, he was a religious Jew, he was not somebody who converted. He was made colonel by Kościuszko, who was an incredibly, somehow, you know, visionary, not only military leader, but also a pre-enlightenment person. And he had a unit of Jews, I mean a kind of a battalion of Jewish soldiers, and they fought very heroically. And then he emigrated after the insurrection collapsed, and then returned to Poland again and died in battle against another occupier, against Austrians. What is unusual about him is that he is inscribed into the Polish history, as no Jews are. He is inscribed because the Polish history, as Maria Janian in fact is writing about, the Polish history is the history of honor, of victimhood, but of honor, of dignified death against overwhelming power of the enemies. And the history. Here I have a little aside that I don't know. I hope I'm not going to take too much time about it. It's the history that I wanted to quote a poet, a Polish poet, who is translated into Bulgarian. His name is Zbigniew Herbert. He was a favorite poet of one of the most favorite poets of the Russian poet Josif Brodsky. Brodsky rejected history, didn't like to talk about history, because for him history was really about murder. And he was saying the history does not repeat itself only because each time it's another person that is being murdered. And he really loved the poetry of Herbert, but Herbert's writing about history is completely different. Zbigniew Herbert history, poetry, and if I have time later on, maybe I can read you this poem that I took, is this heroic history, that is identification with the victims. The victims are not passive. They are not victims in the sense of somebody who is dying a death that is not voluntary. These are people who fight. And the death that is not voluntary is not respected. And this is the division that exists in Polish history. That is, the Polish history is the history of heroic discourse, of this continuous suffering and the continuous fight, and unsuccessful but repeated attestation to one's own dignity. In that sense, for example, if you read, or you know, there's the only surviving leader of Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, because in 1943 there was an uprising in Warsaw Ghetto when the ghetto was already being liquidated. And there's a man who was one of the leaders, very young at that time, whose name is Marek Edelman, who was many times said that we decided to fight, although we knew it was hopeless, because the outside world respected this type of death. Because we knew that the people around us who died as dignified death as we will die, their death was not considered part of history. So this is why we made this gesture. We just wanted to show that Jews can die in the same way the Poles are dying. And this death of people who were gassed, who were massacred, who were transported, this was black death. And the other death was the death in the light of the day. It was the noble death. I want to return now to this, to Berek Yoselevich. What this Maria Yanyan is saying, showing on the example of this one military Jew that is included into this Polish heroic discourse, she's showing that this is this separation between the heroic and non-heroic discourse is the one that allows the separation between Polish and Jewish history. And that this is something that needs somehow to be undermined and rejected. And it has to be undermined and rejected now, because the history of Second World War is coming more to clearly, becoming more and more visible. This is a paradoxical thing again, and I think there's a famous quote from Thomas Mann. He said that the least visible is the history that is closest to us. Now, Second World War is receding into the past, and further it is away from us, clearer it becomes. And it is clearly visible that the history as it has been written and understood till now is not acceptable anymore. That if we talk about Second World War, it is history not so much of honor, but it is a history of horror. Because the history of the extermination of Jews happened on the Polish territory. It was, of course, not done by Poles. It was done by the Germans. It was organized by the Germans. It was not the Polish idea, and it cannot be ascribed in any way to the Polish population. Nevertheless, it did happen on the Polish territory. There were, and now it is, I remember very well when I was a child, and when how all of this was represented, how all of this history was presented, and how it was understood basically by everybody of my generation and later, of people born after the war. It was like, it was that these people just went away. There were some German soldiers, and this population just marched to the gas chambers. You know, it was kind of, in a certain way, a void. It was a clean vision of history, and not without really going into any details, without understanding, without really even premonition of how much violence is needed in order to exterminate the entire nation, and how many kinds of violence and how many people have to be involved in it, and how complicated this whole thing is, and how many traces of that remain. So this history of horror that is coming back in a certain way is coming back also because the victims of that, the victims of this, I mean, the silence was possible also because those who survived were, in a certain way, shamed into silence, because there was no vocabulary, in a certain way, within the Polish historical discourse, how to talk about suffering. It was humiliating to spend 4 years hidden in a closet at some house and having to pay people to bring you food. Yes, it is, or it was shameful to be change your name and pretending you are somebody else, and there was shame attached to surviving. And now, because of many reasons, because of the fact that this war is getting distant, and because of the fact that there's much more awareness of massacres, because we are seeing all the time the wars, and these wars are all against civilians. And this whole division, this whole kind of structure of this government, of this history, which is so much built up by the Polish government, of the heroic victimhood, of the voluntary death, this whole structure is in a way crumbling the other side. And this is, in a certain way, I don't know how to describe it. It is kind of a civilian history that is being written, or it is a democratized history that is the dead, those murdered, are more visible. They, in a certain way, are regaining their voice. They are being seen, and they are being, they, in a way, speak. And this is not only the Polish phenomenon in the writing of history. I just, thinking about this, I just read the first two books, historical books in America that came out in the last 3 months. And these are two, again, I'm not going to describe them very, very thoroughly, but these are books. One is by a historian from University of Pittsburgh. It's called The Slave Ship. And it is about it's about slavery. It's about the transportation of slaves from Africa to the United States. And it has a very interesting subtitle. The title is The Slave Ship, and subtitle is A Human History. And it is an effort by this historian of retrieving every voice of a person that went through that trip, and any sign of individuality of people under the deck, and the way, you know, there were something like almost 13 million people that were transported. Of this 13 million people, at least 2 million died on the way. There were these boats, these ships were followed by fish that were feeding on them all throughout, feeding on these bodies that were thrown there. So this is one book, an amazing book, trying to write this history, the history of those who didn't have a voice. And the second book that I read, again published, basically published last month, was written by the woman historian Drew Gilpin Faust, who is, became director of the president of Harvard University, and it's about the American Civil War, and it's about the dead, about the bodies that have been that remained on, because both of these situations, both the transportation of the slaves and this American Civil War, these were gigantic massacres. So this is, she looked at it, she wrote about it in a way that is very unusual. It is not about the fallen one, as is, the fallen ones are the subject of Polish history, those who fought the voluntary death. It is about those who were massacred, who were killed, who, and she says one thing, this was a very great quotation from her. She said, human beings are rarely simply passive victims of death. They are actors, even if they are the dyers, the those who die. They prepare for death, imagine it, risk it, endure it, seek to understand it. And in that way, she's writing a completely, in a certain way, new history of that war that is mostly described in military terms. So these two books are basically writing something that could be called the individual history of horror. They are history, both of them based on historical research and on historical facts, but they are kind of putting the voices of those who were not part of not subjects of history before. They are making them talk. And I feel that the result, why this history is written in such a way, it is the history is written not only because of what I said, that we are witnessing, we are more aware of the massacres now, that we somehow believe, if we, for example, look at the war in Iraq, we see that the soldiers are not knights, and the victims are not real enemies. You know that we see that these wars are against civilian populations. That this is where the massacre is happening. That really these wars have to be really understood in terms of massacre, of horror, of terror, rather than of these other terms. And I think that the reason for it is also because of this effort that happened in the United States, at least, that is that the descendants of the slaves were collecting testimonies and trying to make individual stories about their ancestors. The same thing with the Shoah and the Holocaust testimonies, this effort at taking individual testimonies, and these stories are repeating themselves, but each time this is another person that was killed or another person that survived. And this is in this context that this book of Jan Gross enters into this debate in Polish history. That is what he is doing, he is making the Jewish history entering into the middle of the Polish history. He, in a certain way, gives the citizenship of Polish history to the Polish Jews. And this is in a certain way, a scandal, because the Polish history is written in such a way that it does not include Shoah. It is, if you read these histories, it's about, if you read the history, Jewish history of the war and Polish history of the war, it is as if they happened in different places, as if they happened not to different ethnicities, but in a different moment. So what he does with this book, he reclaims a place of the Polish Jews in Polish history and says that this is one history, that there are no two sides. There's no dialogue, as they say in Polish, we have to have Polish-Jewish dialogue. So this is one history, and this is human history. Thank you. It's up to you, because if you want to speak in Bulgarian, here I have help. Yeah.
This is a question from Mr. Dragomir Stoyanov from the University. His question is whether modern people in Poland perceive the history of Jews in Poland as a traumatic experience, as a trauma, or not? Or is it a part of history that is kept in silence for modern Poles? Then, if studies are mostly made outside the country, speaking about Jews,
The vision that in Polish public discourse about the history of Jews in Poland is a history of great tolerance on the part of the Poles. That is, the Jews have been accepted into Poland after basically kind of starting in 14th century. And so that every Pole you will meet, you will tell you, every child learns this in school, that Poland was the only country that was accepting Jews at that time, and that the Jews were blossoming in Poland. And many Jewish historians will say the same thing. And then, of course, this history was very very complicated. Very, you know, good and bad, but then it ended. It really ended, and I think it ended. Who knows? But the difficulty in approaching it is that it is a great trauma. It is a great trauma. It is a great trauma to Polska. You can imagine that. This is a population that witnessed, you know, the people who were the best did not participate in it. Some people participated, some people helped, some people didn't help. What does it mean for an entire population to be present, even present, at such a horrendous thing, that in every town, in every village, in every big town, it was, it was really 3 million people of Polish citizens. I don't speak about other Jews, but you know, 3 million people out of a population of 27 at that time, 27 million. Another 3 million Poles died. You know, so it was a trauma, also martyrology. Incredible destruction of the country. The war was against the Poles also. But the inability of talking about it, I think, made this trauma more strong. And the inability of talking about it was common. It was not only Polish. It was Jewish. It was Jews in Israel who couldn't talk about it. It was in the West Europe. You know, there was a silence. There was some kind of like a freezing of the trauma after the war. So it's not only Polish. But the fact that it was not spoken about, and that they were the Jews first, who first started to talk about it, and that they claimed for themselves, I'm talking from the Polish point of view, they claimed for themselves greater destruction than Poles did. This is the what now makes this discussion difficult. The conversation is going on, and the conversation is very violent, but it's a conversation. There is as a reaction to this book and to this discussion about the book. The book has sold in 2 months 70,000 copies. The Institute of National Memory presented another book, counter book, that is in this kind of very 1930s nationalistic tradition, interpretation of the same period. So there's this real debate. There are many people who are very ready to listen to it, and the author had a lot of very positive reaction from younger people, from people who are, you know, in their 30s. But there is also a creation of a new political party, movement, right-wing movement, which meets in the churches, met so far in the churches, which is calling for the defense of Poland and the Polish church against the Jews, you know, and especially against the Brooklyn Jews, which is the Brooklyn Jew, which is the horror. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Ivar Vodice from Sofia University. Thank you. Very interesting talk. I think that what you have told us about Poland is relevant nowadays. There is some sort of, I would say, call it Holocaust envy, so to say. Many nations want to have their Holocaust. Even in Bulgaria, last year we had some people who wanted to pass a law in parliament that Bulgaria was supposed to have had this been subject to Holocaust during the late Ottoman time. But I mean, you touch here to a very, very important question, and I'll put it in these terms: your opposition between horror and pride.
Honor.
Yeah. I would say that all history has always been written about death. Because always death is the sign that remains somehow in time, and was essentially the substance of history. But what happened somewhere in the 19th century, I would say, is that the death of the hero was replaced by the death of the victim. The voluntary heroic act was replaced by the killing of innocent people. And gradually, the optics changed. Actually, nowadays we'll never talk about, say, the Israeli military people who are killed also, but we always talk about the children who die of this rocket, for instance. Mm-hmm. You see this part, sort of thing. And I will ask you why. My personal explanation would be that, again, somewhere in the 19th century, for some reason, death and suffering lost their sense. They no longer have a cultural meaning. Maybe, but that's again a question. Why is it like that? But do you have an explanation? Why would this sort of new situation has occurred.
For the first point that you made about the Bulgarians and the Bulgarians also having this kind of the Holocaust envy, I think that this commonality of victimhood, that there's one thing that maybe this is my suggestion, that in order to have a legitimate state, you need to have a sacrifice before. That even French have la chanson de Roland. Yes, even there's always, if you look at it, there's always somebody who dies for the state. In a way, it is built on blood and sacrifice. So this is why everybody needs to have that in their past, and this is why it is so common. You know, Serbia. You think about. If you look at all these images, this is all the same.
But in the case of Kosovo, you have innocent people, and not the heroes who are.
Yeah. But it is a very new state. We'll see how it is going to build its legitimacy. Although they have been victimized, so they don't need to look very far. But. I feel that what happens, why the death is losing, why this heroic death is not possible anymore, is that maybe this is one of the possible answers. This is a very difficult, it's a very important question, is that we are seeing the massacres, we are seeing them, that there's a certain kind of visibility that appears with this opening of the world, and that if we were within our world, it was very clear that, in Poland it was very clear that the Russians are not victims, but Poles are victims. And even if Russian children died, these were the necessary, you understand. There was a very limited amount of actors. But now we can look at Palestinians, yes, and we can see the victims. This has nothing to do with us. We are not the ones that are involved in this fight. So, and also we experience them. I think that the First World War and the Second World War shook completely the European culture and the European civilization and undermined these kind of dualities which allowed us to live orderly state life. And that now, very slowly, we are trying to come out of it. The European Union effort is the effort of trying to overcome this absolutely ingrained conviction that one is one's identity is a national identity, and the nation has to have a state, because otherwise it's unjust. Yes? So now we have this European Union experiment, but of limited sovereignty, of collaboration, of control, and so on. But it already produces this nationalism in these countries. So is this is a reaction, I fear, to the fact that our history is not dignified enough anymore. We want to find other ways, consensual ways of living. Is this going to work out? Who knows?
I have a question, and it is very much related to 68, and you say that the interpretation of the 68 is much to do with this, because if before 68, in the Polish history, Jews were the ones who brought communism to Poland, the problem with the 68 was basically that most of the leaders of the 1968 events were Jews, so they became much more the synonymous also with the anti-communism and trying to destroy the communist system. How in the Polish discourse you managed to reconcile these two images of what Jews did in the last 50 years?
First of all, it's not true, of course, that Jews introduced communism. Yeah, there are two ways of interpreting 1968. And both of them are legitimate. And this is where this Polish Jewish history comes to. 1968 was a genuinely Polish insurrection, in some way, in the tradition of Polish insurrection, because it was the rebellion of the students, a rebellion of intelligentsia, and it turns out now, at the studies of these police documents, that it was a rebellion of the workers, but generational rebellion. It was people who were born after the war, these workers, that were rebelling for various reasons. And it lasted for about, you know, strikes and occupations and so on, lasted for about 6 weeks, and they were all throughout Poland, in every high school even. So it is a genuinely Polish insurrection, but it was follow-up by the expulsion of Jews. Anti-Semitism, which was called anti-Zionism, because the word anti-Semitism was discredited, was the kind of the slogan of the party, and it caused and the first party secretary Gomułka gave a speech on March 19th, 1968, saying that those who have two fatherlands rather than one can emigrate to Israel, and in many of the situations, you know, people were pushed. People of Jewish origin were pushed to emigrate. And so, if you look at it from the Polish history, it is a Polish insurrection. Not a big one, not a great one, because thank God probably nobody was killed. And if somebody was killed, it was by accident. But from the Jewish view of history, this is the end of the Holocaust. This is this incredible event that in a country in which 3 million Jews died, there was the government expels the remnants of these Jews, and these are the most Polonized Jews. So these are these two interpretations. And the fact is that many of the leaders of the student leaders were of Jewish origin. Some of them you could say Jews, and some of them would never call themselves Jews. It's true. But you know, you are talking about, I would say, 50 people? 55. Let's go on the safe side, you know? So how can that, it is very, in fact, I don't understand that exactly, why this happened. The one reason may be given, and it's kind of a psychological, in a certain way, personal interpretation, is that the people of Jewish origin who were born in Poland after the war had a very problematic relationship to life. That is, they felt that they have to do something, that they cannot just live their life just day after day. That they have somehow to contribute to the society, they have somehow justified the fact that it is them that are alive. This would be my interpretation.
I'm from Poland, so just to counterbalance the account you have given,
yes.
It's not quite clear for me. You're not living in Poland.
I'm living in.
How long you lived in Poland?
I am part of the.
You were born in Poland.
Yes.
How long you lived there? Till 1968, I believe.
69, yes.
And afterwards, you lived in the United States.
Yes.
And just to make things clear, the person who wrote the book, Fear and. And neighbors is your husband.
It's my former husband.
It's your former husband. So, don't get me wrong, just to make things clear. Who gave you license to tour the world and speak about Polish identity, about honor and horror? Marek Edelman, the difference between you and Marek Edelman, one of the heroes, one of the ghetto fighters, the leader of the ghetto uprising, is that he still lives in my hometown, in Łódź. So the question is, do you feel comfortable touring Europe and spreading the words about national identity?
How would you Would you give me the right to speak about it? Would you give me the right to speak? How can I gain this right from you? Why would you deny me the right to speak like that?
Who gave you? Because
who? I mean, I'm asking who can give me the right.
I'm just curious too. I just want to know
who can give me, who can anoint me to give me the right to talk about identity.
I'm just curious. So it's your personal discussion in the world that you no longer live in, actually.
I am part, I mean, I don't need to explain it because anyone can talk about anything.
Sure, of course.
So, and there's nobody who gives you the right to talk about Poland. And I am not somebody who will tell you not to talk about Poland because you are whatever you are and whoever you are. The thing is that there is, and the content of my speech was that this is not something that is given the right to speak about it by the government or by the ministry and by the museum. That this history, the monopoly on history, it never existed, and it's not going to function.
I'm talking about personal experience. What kind of personal experience?
My personal experience is such that I grew up in a Polonized family. I was a leader, one of the leaders, and arrested and sentenced in 1968 at Warsaw University. After that, I was forced to emigrate. Because I could not, I couldn't go to study, I couldn't get a work, and I was continuously harassed by the police.
No, I feel sorry about
this. I lived in Italy and in the United States, and I was all the time in contact with my friends who remained in Poland. We were publishing publications. We were spreading the word about Poland all the time in the mass media to protect the people who were dissidents in Poland. We were doing a lot of things. And in 1990, as soon as it was possible, I came back to Poland. And I am continuously between Poland and so on. So if residency is something that you need in order to be able to talk about identity, I have interrupted residency, but I do have residency. I have been working on Poland and working in a sense, not professionally in the sense that, but writing on it and politically committed to democratization and to change of the regime from very early on.
I have no doubts about it, but the difference is that those people who stay in Poland, they are Adam Michnik, Jacek Kuron, they have set up Committee for Defense of Workers, and they make things change. So the reason why there were so many Jews in Poland, as you know better than me, is that they felt pretty safe in Poland. Pogrom is Russian word, not Polish. Pogrom was invention of Russians. So I'm just, you know, act like advocatus diaboli, just to counterbalance the view. I do respect your contribution, but I'm only afraid that our Bulgarian friend could have some, let's say, mixed feelings about the whole thing. But thank you very much for this.
Bulgarians can speak for their mixed feeling by themselves. They don't need defenders. I don't have mixed feelings. I have curiosity about certain things, and I would like to ask you some questions. Because the logic of your presentation was that there is a kind of dominant historiographic narrative of the Polish nation where the self-victimization and heroic self-victimizations are in the center, so to say, and only pure Polish people are capable of doing that. And this is the very core of Polishness, to do such kind of heroic victimizing act. But from your point of view, certain authors, certain books can, let's say, attack this narrative and demonstrate that there are also Jews or other representative minorities capable of doing that. This is still in the logic of the grand narrative. You remember that in 1972, in his famous book about the postmodern condition, Lyotard predicted that the grand narratives are over, and the general energy of these grand narratives, social trust in them, is over. And he expected that all these great narrative structures organizing time, solidarity and collectivities will be over, and they will be replaced by kind of minor narratives, various social techniques of building small solidarity groups and communities and so on, a network society, to use the contemporary term. Obviously, it didn't happen like that. And you're analyzing the Polish situation as if the grand Polish narrative has been never put in question. My question is that really so? Is that this historic narrative so strong? Is the emotional investment and the trust investment in this narrative so strong in all the layers of the society? Is this narrative such a strong institution in order to be really challenged, put in questions, let's say, made fluid and osmotic in order for other people to penetrate in it, and so on and so on? So in how far the grand narrative of Polish nationhood is still vibrant, and it is sociologically supported by various groups of the society? This is unclear in a way for me, because you speak as if this narrative has been never been challenged. And what about other possible narratives about the way to Europe, unification with the civilized world and so on? Why aren't they so active? What happened with them? And this explanation that the unification with the European Union all of a sudden blocked all these feelings and in a way triggered barbaric kind of nationalism, I don't believe in that. Maybe it is more sophisticated, more complicated.
Yes, it is more sophisticated, and this narrative has been challenged many times and very famously. Poland, you have a much longer liberation, you know, time than Poland. Poland is independent from 1918. And soon after Poland was, and therefore before the independence, of course, statehood, of course, there was this very, there was several unsuccessful insurrections, and there was, even then, there were two narratives within the within the Polish history. That is, one was, which was romantic, and another one which was so-called positivistic, that is, which was saying, let's not lose any more blood, let's work, let's develop civilization, and then we'll see what will come out of it. Right after 1918, there were several people, there was a famous poet, Lechon, who wrote a poem saying, when there's spring, I want to think about spring, not about Poland. And he wrote it already in 1920. And there are many, you know, there's a writer, Gombrowicz, there are many, very many ways of undermining this narrative that I did not mention. So this is not something that is unchallenged. What it is, why I'm so emotionally talking about it, is that it revived. That it seemed that while Poland is present in the European Union, that it's not going to be there, but at least not dominant. But now, if you looked at the previous government, Polish government, and this kind of sense of insecurity within Europe and resentment both towards Germans and towards Russia, you know, you could see that this and all these museums about which I was talking, and all this, this is how Polishness is being taught. This is how it is taught in schools. It is challenged by many groups and by many, many people. It's very interesting that you say that, you know, that you mentioned the hotel, and when, that you mentioned this end of God narrative, because you know, this was written, his book was written around 68. It was kind of a 1968 philosophy in a certain way. And none of this philosophy, none of it really proved to be true. None of this undermining of order, of narratives. There is some kind of reconstruction. Maybe it is, as I was saying, maybe it is a moment of transition. Maybe there will be some changes. But if you look at what's happening in the United States, at this growth of nationalism, militancy, militarism, of return to old symbols, or of kind of the entire country being covered with flags, against whom? This means that, you know, there's a certain kind of consolidation of that great grand narrative that is alive, and that is what so much worries me.
Thank you very much. Thank you.